Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and here's why President Donald Trump is now perilously close to an obstruction of justice charge. On Friday, Trump's original national security advisor, Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russia. The lying took place while he and Trump were in office or in the transition to office. On Saturday, Trump tweeted, "I had to fire General Flynn because he lied to the vice president and the FBI. He has pled guilty to those lies." That tweet contained something Trump had never said before, that he fired Flynn for lying to the FBI. Back in February, he said this at a news conference.
"No, I fired him because of what he said to Mike Pence. Very simple."
Very simple. However, in an NBC News interview with Lester Holt around then, he hinted at it being more than that.
"My White House counsel came to me. They had, I believe, two meetings, and we ultimately fired, but we fired for a different reason."
"You're talking about General Flynn?"
"General Flynn, yes."
Because of lying to the vice president?
"Yeah, but everything plays in. Everything plays into it. But we fired him because he said something to the vice president that was not so."
So he maybe hinted at it a little bit, everything plays in, but he still landed on, "We fired him because he said something to the vice president that wasn't so." So why does this change in Trump's story matter, that he fired Flynn for lying to the FBI, not just for lying to Mike Pence? Well, because James Comey testified under oath in a congressional hearing that Trump asked Comey, as FBI director, to go easy on Flynn after Trump fired him. Here's that moment.
"I understood him to be saying that what he wanted me to do was drop any investigation connected to Flynn's account of his conversations with the Russians."
So think about it. If Trump knew that Flynn lied to the FBI and then used the office of the president to pressure the FBI not to discover or investigate that crime, then Trump was trying to cover up Michael Flynn's felony. And that might be obstruction of justice. Here is Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. This weekend, she's on the Judiciary Committee as the ranking Democrat.
"The Judiciary Committee has an investigation going as well, and it involves obstruction of justice. And I think what we're beginning to see is the putting together of a case of obstruction of justice. I think we see this in the indictments, the four indictments and pleas that have just taken place, in some of the comments that are being made. I see it in the hyperphonetic attitude of the White House, the comments every day, the continual tweets, and I see it most importantly in what happened with the firing of Director Comey, and it is my belief that that is directly because he did not agree to lift the cloud of the Russia investigation. That's obstruction of justice."
Dianne Feinstein on Meet the Press. So the president via Twitter on Saturday seemed to implicate himself in obstruction of justice. He did that by stating that he knew Flynn lied to the FBI, possibly before the FBI knew that, and that he asked the FBI director not to investigate the case when you put together the breadcrumbs. But now it gets really weird. On Sunday, one of Trump's lawyers, John Dowd, said Trump didn't write Saturday's tweet. He, the lawyer, wrote the tweet. Really weird, right? Trump usually tweets in his own voice, and there is no known instance of someone taking the reins for him like that before this. One theory of what's going on here, the lawyer lied on Twitter about Trump knowing Flynn lied to the FBI to distance Trump from Flynn in the court of public opinion with that nice, juicy fact. "Yeah, that bad Michael Flynn lied to the FBI, and righteous me, Donald Trump, fired him for it." But now the lawyer seems to want to take back that big, juicy fact and say, no, my mistake. Trump only knew that Flynn lied to Mike Pence. Then the tweet wouldn't be implicating the president in obstruction of justice. So either the lawyer is lying about writing the tweet, the lawyer was lying about Trump knowing Flynn lied to the FBI, Trump himself was lying about knowing Flynn lied to the FBI, or they were telling the truth about knowing Flynn lied to the FBI, which could be obstruction of justice. Confusing, I know, but oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive. And now we have two Trump advisors having pled guilty this fall for lying to the FBI about their contacts with Russia, Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos. It remains unclear why they bothered to risk those lies. What were they really covering up? Still unknown. With me now to talk about that and the tax bill as it goes to a House Senate conference committee, Sabrina Siddiqui, Washington correspondent for The Guardian. Thanks for doing this, Sabrina. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And I know you wanted to comment on our last segment, too. And I know that in October, the Washington Post had a story that included your story of being harassed online for a veteran reporter. What would you like to add?
Well, I think I just wanted to speak to the prevalence of sexual harassment that women face across all industries. And at the time of that interview, the focus had been on Harvey Weinstein and the entertainment industry and politics as well. But I think what the point I was trying to make is I think every single woman has a story, if not multiple stories, of being sexually harassed in some way. And sometimes it's untoward behavior and unwanted advances that you face from male colleagues or associates. Sometimes it's a lot worse. I wouldn't in any way compare my experience. I was still fortunate ultimately that it was all online and nothing that I faced in person in terms of contact, unwanted physical contact. But it can also be something as simple as being shut down in meetings, being condescended to, which is some of what you were speaking to in your segment. But I think it took me about 7 years or so to really be able to talk about how vulnerable I felt in that moment, being about 24 years old, looking for a job, and having this older veteran male reporter think he could take advantage of me and take advantage of my more vulnerable position by propositioning me online and making me feel uncomfortable, knowing that I felt at the time like I couldn't say anything because it would be his word against mine. And in that case, I'm pretty sure back then, especially, his word would have won.
So how do you feel watching this whole, I guess we might call it post-Harvey Weinstein moment, unfold all around the country?
I think that it's very gratifying in some ways, although, of course, it makes you immensely sad because you do realize just how pervasive the problem is. You see how horrific the experience of so many of these women have been. And I think the running theme here is that these men have been able to do it over the course of years, if not decades, without any repercussions. And so, you know, in some cases, although they've now been relieved from their jobs, it's the women who lost their careers or who suffered setbacks, while the men still ultimately created an empire. And I think that that was sort of the way that I had felt, where I didn't think I could say anything because I was a young reporter looking for a job and I didn't want to hinder my prospects. So I just tried to compartmentalize it and put it to a side. And a lot of women do that. And I think that now the burden in some ways has been lifted. I hope it continues in this direction. But there's something to be said for the fact that I think there are a lot of women who still speak anonymously because they still fear retaliation. And I think that fear is still very real, in part because, frankly speaking, you have people at the highest office of the land who are about to speak about on another issue who have publicly denigrated women and threatened retaliation when they've been accused of misconduct. So we still have a long way to go. And I think that especially because, you know, as a political reporter, I cover politics. That's where we've certainly seen far less accountability than you're seeing in other fields.
My guest is Sabrina Siddiqui, Washington correspondent for The Guardian. Turning to the Trump-Michael Flynn story, can you shed any more light on the attorney John Dowd story that I just kind of went through? Since when does he tweet things in Trump's name without Trump's knowledge?
You know, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said either the attorney is lying or the president is lying or they're both telling the truth, but then the truth means that the president could be implicated in obstruction of justice. It's significant in for all the reasons that you said, which is this is the first time that we've heard any sort of acknowledgement that the president was aware that Michael Flynn had lied to the FBI. And it underscores once again just how much the story has changed. We were talking in this particular moment about Michael Flynn, and it kind of harkens back to when he was even fired, where the timeline of that, the chronology of that was significant, because it wasn't until the Washington Post had reported that Flynn lied to Mike Pence that he was eventually fired. And at first, the White House sought to defend him, choosing Flynn over their vice president. And it was clear that the president knew at the time that his national security advisor had lied to his own president. And they tried to point to eventually terminating Flynn from his position as some sort of sign of strength when, had it not been for the press reports, by all accounts, he would have still been there. We also, in subsequent reporting, learned about how Sally Yates had warned the White House far earlier that she was concerned Flynn was compromised because she saw that he had lied to the vice president. The vice president was clearly or seemingly unaware of it. And so I think it just highlights the evolving story, which really suggests that potentially the cover-up is worse than the crime, is what they say.
I see in the Washington Post this morning that Dowd did clarify yesterday that Trump did have the information in January that Flynn probably gave the same inaccurate information about the nature of his Russia contacts to the FBI that he gave to Pence. In other words, Trump's own lawyer is now saying, according to the Washington Post, that Trump knew Flynn probably committed a crime before Trump asked Comey to let that crime go. So that's one new wrinkle in how they keep kind of flipping the story into different positions. And another one that I guess is the other piece to that is that now Trump is saying Comey lied about that exchange. Trump says he never asked Comey to let the Flynn thing go. So we may have Trump's word against Comey's word and Comey's written notes that he made at the time about their conversation would be part of that. So who a grand jury believes might determine whether there's an obstruction of justice charge?
I think so. Insofar as there may not be a paper trail that leads back to the president, you have Comey's notes. That's the closest that we seem to have in this moment. Of course, there's a lot we don't know, as we've seen with the special counsel inquiry led by Robert Mueller. But I think the timeline, is important. Just to reiterate, it was on January 26th that Acting General Sally Yates had warned the White House about that she was concerned that Flynn was lying to them and that federal officials had evidence of that. And despite knowing about Flynn's lies, Trump continued to defend him. He met, as you said, with James Comey at February 14th. Yeah, fired Sally Yates. Yes. Instead of firing Mike Flynn, he fired Sally Yates and said it was because she refused to defend the travel ban. But he only fired Mike Flynn, as we said, as news became public of Yates's warning. And so clearly they're willing to wait a long time until it really boiled to the surface. But as you know, I think it is Comey's word against the rest. But there is one person who has a history of not telling the truth or distorting the truth or outright lying. And then you have one person who does not. And I don't think anyone needs to guess that it's Comey, who has not been found to have credibility problems. And it's the president who has, throughout this investigation, not only had problems with his own credibility, but actively sought to dismiss the entire investigation as fake news, as a hoax, and as a witch hunt, and not repeatedly at least tried to intervene, if not potentially obstruct justice.
Let's go on to the tax bill. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Guardian Washington correspondent Sabrina Siddiqui. It passed the Senate Friday after passing the House in a different form. What would you say are the trickiest parts of trying to reconcile the two versions? Have you looked at that?
I have looked at it, and I think that there are a number of issues. One is this, is first of all, the question of individual tax rates. The House plan would collapse the 7 individual tax brackets into 4 while keeping the top rate at 39.6%. The Senate bill keeps 7 brackets and it drops the top rate to 38.5%. So that's certainly one of the big distinctions. The estate tax is also something that Trump himself has been very vocal about. He has called it a so-called death tax. He would like to see it repealed. Incidentally, that disproportionately benefits Trump and his cabinet. And in the House bill, they would double the exemption for this so-called for the death tax, or a so-called death tax, estate tax, and eliminate it beginning in 2024. The Senate does double the exemption as well, but it leaves the tax in place. So it does not meet the president's call to eliminate it outright. So those are two big ones. There's a mortgage interest deduction, and the Senate plan doesn't really make significant changes to that, keeping it at a $1 million deduction cap. The House bill, that was a big one. It capped the deduction at $500,000 on home loans. And that was something that was a last-minute provision of the House bill that almost imperiled its passage. So it could be that you see the Senate prevail in not really making significant changes to the deduction for mortgages, which of course really, really impacts, the majority of Americans in a significant way. So those are some of the key distinctions. And I think that while it was significant that Senate Republicans overcame all of their concerns, or at least put them aside, and were willing to advance this bill, there are a lot of obstacles ahead in terms of reconciling their legislation with that of the House.
There were also last-minute changes to the Senate bill from what had been debated publicly here and many other places, you know, compared to that earlier draft. I was just getting my notes together on this, so tell me if I'm repeating anything that you just said. But one is that property taxes up to $10,000 can still be a tax-deductible expense for your federal taxes under the Senate bill as it passed. The earlier version would have eliminated the deduction for all state and local taxes. Now $10,000 of property tax still can be deducted. And the alternative minimum tax that stops wealthy people from avoiding all taxes through loopholes was going to go away completely. It was restored in the final version of the Senate bill to apply to the very wealthiest. Anything else you'd note? Because there was so much like last minute scribbling that changed things that actually had been publicly debated for a while.
Yes, I think that the Senate restored a corporate alternative minimum tax. First, it was going to eliminate that provision. The House scraps the corporate alternative minimum tax altogether. I think that the key here is that these differences are ultimately worth hundreds of billions of dollars. So we're not talking about a small amount of change, and especially when you look at the way in which the Senate bill was projected to balloon the deficit, and for that matter, the House bill also added to the deficit, but the Senate bill, prior to some of the last-minute changes, was going to add more than $1 trillion to the deficit, and suddenly many of the deficit hawks, except for Bob Corker, who was the only Republican to vote against it, but many of the deficit hawks decided that they no longer cared about ballooning the deficit. I think when you're looking at these differences and the question of how do you pay for these tax cuts, a lot of these are the sources of revenue that they're looking for to pay for these bills. So that's where you could see significant trouble, is how do they make the math work?
Yeah.
And those were the obstacles they faced leading up to those votes, and why it was dicey in both the House and the Senate, and ultimately why it will continue to be dicey when they get to final votes after reconciliation.
And the House version does not have the end to the Obamacare individual mandate to buy insurance. The Senate version does. Can you tell, are there tea leaves? Can you play pundit and tell us if you think that's going to wind up in or out?
Well, I think that it's somewhat surprising because would have seemed a bigger lift in the Senate, because that's where they really stumbled in their efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. The House passed the bill in May, and it was in the Senate where they had significant opposition from a handful of moderates: Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, John McCain, over multiple issues with that process. But I think when they added that piece to the Senate, it looked like it would be difficult for them to get people on board. And in the end, Susan Collins, who was the biggest opponent of including the mandate repeal, she voted for it anyway. So I think that in the House, you have certainly been driven more by this steadfast ideology against Obamacare. I think the question, though, is, you know, what do they do moving forward? Susan Collins said she only voted for the tax plan with the individual mandate repeal because she wanted them to also at the same time advance a bill to stabilize the insurance markets, in essence, stabilize Obamacare. So if they put that in, are Republicans in the House going to, and the Senate for that matter, going to allow for that as a compromise? They see that as a bailout of Obamacare. So it kind of seems as though the individual mandate debate is not yet over, because Susan Collins is effectively saying, I was willing to advance it so we could go reconcile the two bills, but I'm not done in fighting this mandate repeal. So I do think that's sort of signaling that there's more obstacles ahead on that question. But I'll just reiterate the stats. The projection was that including the mandate repeal in the tax plan would lead to 13 million more uninsured over a period of 10 years.
Now, there's also the question of the federal budget for next year with a deadline of this Friday. And New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is among those Democrats threatening not to vote for any budget, threatening a government shutdown if the spending bill doesn't also include a fix for the DACA policy, which, of course, allows the young adult immigrants brought here illegally as children by their parents to stay and work legally. The DACA program will end in March unless Congress or the president do something to save it. Here is Senator Gillibrand.
If Republicans refuse to do the right thing and protect Dreamers in this upcoming long-term spending bill, they are going to cause the government to shut down. Because I'm not going to vote for a long-term spending bill that doesn't protect our Dreamers. Period. It's that simple.
Wow, Sabrina, are the Democrats really ready to shut down the government, which is usually seen as a Republican thing?
I wouldn't put it out of the question because they believe they have the upper hand. And I think Republicans know that Democrats have the upper hand. Now, Paul Ryan has all but said that he sees DACA as a separate issue from the spending bill, which is essentially put saying, we'll deal with DACA later. We want to fix it, but we have some time. We have until March. That was when the program officially phases out. And that's sort of signaling that Republicans are willing to really pave the way for a potential shutdown. I think the question is who bears the blame, and Democrats know that Republicans control both chambers of Congress and the White House. So the likelihood that Democrats would shoulder the blame is pretty small in the eyes of the minority party. That how would it really be that when Trump and Republicans have all of the power that we're going to be blamed for shutting down the government, and they also have arguably one of the most sympathetic groups in the country that they're in this particular case taking a stand on, which is these nearly 700,000 young undocumented immigrants who've been thrown into limbo. And they know that Republicans, there's a lot of Republicans who do want to actually resolve the status of Dreamers. And so I think they're almost threatening them to vote against the interests and the fate of Dreamers just in the pursuit of appeasing the president. So I don't know how it all plays out because it's the early stages, but I think that you could very well see a short-term spending bill, something that looks like a couple weeks or a couple months where they kick the can down the road again, because I do think that Paul Ryan and Republican leaders in general are very concerned with the optics here, as well as knowing that Democrats have a lot of the leverage in this particular fight.
So is it really this Friday that that's going to happen or not happen? Government shutdown?
Well, we'll see. I think that they floated Republican leaders something like a 1 week or a spending bill, like a 1 week, a very short-term fix to give themselves more time. I think that we'll see. I mean, I think that Democrats could very well just say, no, what's going to change in 1 week? We either resolve this now or we shut down the government.
Wow.
So we've seen this show before, but we've seen it at a time when you had Obama and Democrats controlling, you know, the White House and the Senate, but you did have Republicans in control of the House. You didn't have one party controlling all of Washington. So here the blame would be a lot easier to ascribe in the eyes of the American public. That's at least the calculation Democrats are making.
Sabrina, one other story before you go. This morning, Trump tweeted an actual endorsement for Roy Moore for Senate in Alabama. That election is next Tuesday. He always seemed to be supporting Roy Moore, despite the sexual abuse allegations against him. So what's new here?
Well, he is making it about as explicit as he can that he supports Roy Moore, a man who has been accused of sexually assaulting underage girls. The women who've come forward many of them said that they were molested or assaulted by Moore when they were as young as 14 and 16. So I think that it's not surprising to the people who have watched Trump and the way that in which he responded to this entire controversy, first ignoring it outright, then signaling he was favoring Moore. What's been more striking is a number of Republicans, including Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, went on television yesterday on Sunday shows and said that it's up to the people of Alabama to decide. And that is a notable turnaround, because McConnell and other Republicans in the Senate, as more and more allegations were reported, they were the first to say this man has no place in the Senate, he should step aside. And you see how the president has now put them in this position where they are effectively arguing that the decision should in fact be left up to Alabama voters, which calls into question, are they really going to expel him, as they once said, should he win in December, or should he win in a couple of weeks? That remains to be seen. And I think this is where the initial promises they made that they would immediately begin expulsion proceedings if Roemer came to the Senate, I think those look a lot more skeptical today.
Sabrina Siddiqui, Washington correspondent for The Guardian, thank you so much.
Thank you.